Don't judge a book by its title. This is a play on what you would normally hear as sort of, you might call it an idiom. Don't judge a book by its cover. Yet we're living in the electronic age that most books don't have covers anymore. But there's a title. You can't always judge a book by its title. Here to judge, I am referring to the contents of the book based on its title. You're not judging whether it's good or not, but you're judging based on what you expect to see or read based on the title of the book. How many of you here choose a book because of its title? Oh, that sounds interesting. Then you get 4 or 5 pages in and it's like, what did I just buy? For instance, if you read The Temple by Robert Cornuke, you would expect the contents to be about the temple. And you wouldn't be disappointed either. It was not only about the temple, but about the location of the Temple Mount. Is it really where everyone thinks it is? We know it today as the Western Wall. There has been very little debate about this location over the centuries. However, Mr. Cornuke utilizes both biblical testimony and archaeological evidence to convey a much different conclusion. That which is not truly still supported today, but who knows what God can do. On the other hand, you look at what many consider to be a classic piece of literature, Lord of the Flies. What would you expect from this title? Would you expect the following? A 1954 novel by Nobel Prize winning British author William Golding. The book focuses on a group of British boys stranded on an uninhabited island and their disastrous attempt to govern themselves. Themes include the tension between groupthink and individuality, between rational and emotional reactions, and between morality and immorality. Did you get that from the title? Lord of the Flies, it sounds like an alien movie or something. What about Catcher in the Rye? J.D. Salinger, published in 1945 and 46, was a novel. It was originally intended for adults, but is often read by adolescents for its themes of angst and alienations. How many of you read Catcher in the Rye in school? Okay. The meaning for the title, Catcher in the Rye, comes from, or is a reference to, Common Throw the Rye, a Robert Burns poem and a symbol for the main character's longing to preserve the innocence of childhood. Did you get that from the title? So a title doesn't always give you a true glimpse into the book that you were about to read. In many instances, titles are meant to capture your attention, your interest, and pique your curiosity. Some of you have already testified to buying a book solely based on the title because it made you curious. Can you tell by the title of my sermon what I am about to talk about? Not specifically. I haven't given you any clues what I'm talking about just yet. For starters, I will say this. It won't be a bunch of book reviews. We have played Bridge Over Troubled Waters today. Simon and Garfunkel. I've referenced J.D. Salinger and Lord of the Flies. It's like, where am I going with this? Keeping in mind, Jerry was influential in the first part. It's like, thank you for helping me incorporate this in. But it does have to do with addressing labels and titles. As we live in this fast-paced world, where our attention spans seems to be getting shorter and shorter. We tend to gravitate towards the executive summary and the synopsis, a summary of the main points. Just give me the facts, only the facts. It's like, forget about the context, forget about the story around it, so to speak. Got an email earlier this week referencing Black Hebrew Israelites. On the surface, what was your first thought by this title, Black Hebrew Israelites? Just the title itself, nothing that you may know, but you figure, okay, well, they're Black Hebrew Israelites. On the surface, that seems to be the appearance, but when you look a little further, the Black Hebrew group was founded in the United States during the 19th and 20th centuries, from Kansas to New York City, by both African Americans and West Indian immigrants. In the mid-1980s, the number of Black Hebrews in the United States was between 25 and 40,000. Black Hebrew Israelism is a non-homogeneous movement with a number of groups that have varying beliefs, practices, and relationships both to Judaism and Christianity. Yet keeping in mind, it still sounds good on the surface. But sometimes more information is required. If any have been watching the news this past week, you likely have heard about what transpired in Jersey City, New Jersey. Then you have heard of the Black Hebrew Israelites. From a recent article by Daniel Burke in response to the recent shooting. Now let me give you a bit of background, and I'm going to share some more in a bit. Two individuals who were identified as Black Hebrew Israels went into a kosher market in Jersey City, New Jersey, and shot three individuals, all Hasidic Jews. You're keeping in mind, I'm going to share something with you a little more profound in a few minutes. This is what Daniel Burke writes. The Black Hebrew Israelite movement has a complex history in the United States, with seats, with sects and branches splintering into dozens of branches over theological and leadership disputes. So in other words, they are by no means one individual group, but they are many. The movement, which is now is best known for its confrontational brand of street preaching in urban areas, dates back to the 19th century. What unites most Black Israelites is the belief that they are the true descendants of the biblical Jews. Some sects within the movement disdain modern white Jews, experts say, claiming the mantle of the religion for themselves. Black Hebrew Israelites claim to be from the 12 tribes of Israel. We've been down this road a few times with different groups, who will one day be given dominion by God to rule over the earth, said Heidi Beirich, B-E-I-R-I-C-H, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, the SPLC is by no means a popular group. They are a hate group in themselves, but they're for another day. Where SPLC conveyed this. They believe that Jewish people are fake Jews, imposters, who will be supplanted by them in the future. Beirich added, they also believe that God will make whites, who these groups consider spawns of the devil, into their slaves, forced into eternal servitude. Can we say that they're probably on the extreme side of whatever it is? So additionally, what we learned this week was that the kosher market was not the intended target where three Jewish people were shot and killed. The intended target of the individuals from this group was a yeshiva next door, a Jewish school with approximately 50 children. The mayor of Jersey City speculated that if they had reached their intended target, we would be talking about a Sandy Hook level tragedy today. This does not diminish what happened, but conveys it could have been a lot worse. This group is greatly segregated, comprising over 40,000 people probably today, not all of which are radical and hostile towards the Jewish people, but it doesn't take a lot of leaven to leaven the batch of dough. The ones you hear about are the ones to be concerned about. Not too long ago in Washington, there was an uproar over a group of Catholic school kids being the instigators towards a Native American. A small video went viral, and the boys were eviscerated by the media for the sole reason that they were wearing MAGA hats. Donald Trump, make America great again, red hats. Yet when another video was released, it showed the Native American approaching the boys. And mixed into all of this were a group of black Hebrew Israelites actually trying to provoke the Catholic kids. They were seen yelling derogatory statements towards them. Yet keeping in mind the image that was first sent out, the image that was first posted online, was by no means representative of what the actual facts were. Within our mission statement, within our vision statement and our mission, we are to support Israel and the Jewish people in opposing all acts of hatred, anti-Semitism brought against them. So this is from our very website. This is from our vision page, to where this hatred is not to be taken lightly. There is scriptural foundation for just such hatred. So it is nothing new, and yet something we must remain vigilant towards. The book of Esther, chapter 3, starting in verse 8. Then Haman said to the king, there is a particular... a little early, but I see you're getting your training in. Then I'll make sure to pause when... Okay. Then Haman said to the king, there is a particular people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. Moreover, they don't observe the king's laws. It doesn't befit the king to tolerate them. Sowing of discourse. First step, basically. If it please the king, have a decree written for their destruction, and I will hand over 330 tons of silver to the officials in charge of the king's affairs to deposit in the royal treasury. What is this here? If you want to use the term that's been bandied about for a while, quid pro quo. If you do this, I will give you this. The king took his signet ring, which basically exemplifies the authority. He took it from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hamdada the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, oh, come on, let's get a little festive here. The money is given to you. And the people, too, to do with as seems good to you. Here's a bunch of cash. Do whatever you want with it. Consider it pallets of silver. Goes back a few years. You might not have gotten the reference, but anyways. The king's secretaries were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. They wrote down all of Haman's orders. That's it. Like I said, Purim's only a few months away. You need to start preparing. Now I lost my spot. The orders of the kings, the army of commanders and the governors in all the provinces and to the officials of every people, to each province in its own script and to each people in their own language. Everything was written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring. So the king gave his authority to Haman. And Haman used that authority for his own political purpose. Letters were sent by courier to all the royal provinces to destroy, kill, and exterminate all Jews from young to old, including small children and women. On a specific day, the 13th day of the 12th month, this is the first month, so 11 months from this day, there would be not just a Holocaust, an entire obliteration of a people. A copy of the document to be issued as a decree in every province was to be publicly proclaimed to all the peoples so that they would be ready for that day. So here you have a very, very biblically based example of the hatred that we're talking about today. We're not just talking an adversary with differences, but rather an enemy so consumed by hatred that the only solution is a final solution. Again, nothing new under the sun here. The hatred is systemic and rooted in pure evil. Its origins are direct from the adversary himself. As we know, one of the adversary's deceptions is deception. The black Hebrew Israelite groups have claimed to be of Jewish descent, offer no foundational proof, and as such have been denied under Israel's law of return, hence further fueling the hatred for the Jewish people. They are only one group of many who have been attempting to deny the Jewish people their heritage. Whether it's Islam claiming to be the rightful heir of Abraham, Seventh-day Adventists claiming to be the people of the promise because they are the true Sabbath keepers, the Catholic Church denigrating the Jewish people for killing Jesus, or even mainstream Christianity claiming to have replaced Israel as his covenant people. There is no shortage of deception to go around. Keeping in mind, the tides are turning where not everybody is on that page, but it's still there. Yeshua conveys the following to those gathered around him on the mount, a primarily Jewish audience, hears these words. Matthew chapter 7, starting in verse 15. Beware of the false prophets. They come to you wearing sheep's clothing, but underneath they are hungry wolves. You will recognize them by their fruit. Can people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every healthy tree produces good fruit, but a poor tree produces bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, or a poor tree good fruit. Any tree that does not produce good fruit is cut down and thrown in the fire. So you will recognize them by their fruit. Yeshua's words. What's the first thing that he says? Beware of false prophets. You will recognize them by the fruit that they, in essence, produce. So when one is identified as being anti-Semitic, do their actions, their deeds, their lifestyle align with their accusations? Or with the accusations against them. Case in point, our president has been labeled a white supremacist and therefore an anti-Semite. Do the facts align? Does his actions align with the title that has been bestowed upon him? Earlier this week, the same week as some from the Black Hebrew Israelites were intending to decimate a yeshiva in Jersey City, New Jersey. Our president was signing an executive order against anti-Semitism. Keep in mind, the very labels placed upon him are still placed upon him when these facts have not changed. His son-in-law is Jewish. He's a modern Orthodox Jew. His daughter, Ivanka, converted to Judaism. She is also a modern Orthodox Jew. Their children, his grandchildren, are Jewish. This is on the personal side. This is his family. What about on the other side? What about on the public side? What about on his actions? He relocated the American embassy to Jerusalem, thereby officially recognizing Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel, a promise made by four previous presidents dating back 25 years, all the way back to Bush 41. Yet none took the initiative to actually put pen to paper and finalize the promise. The only pen to paper that they did was signing a six-month extension. In other words, kicking the can down the road every 6 months. Oh, well, we'll push it out before we actually have to make a decision. Then earlier this year, what did he do? He identified the Golan Heights to be Israel's territory. A decision that took 52 years to happen. And that Israel gained control as a result of the Six-Day War in 1967. Does this sound like the actions of an anti-Semite? If it does, we need to look at our definition. On Tuesday, when he signed the executive order, many were in attendance, including Alan Dershowitz, a Harvard law professor who is a liberal, who is a Democrat, didn't vote for Trump, but is staunchly supportive of Israel. He made the statement, in his 81 years, he spent 65 years on a college campus, which is where this executive order is directed towards. And to paraphrase, he said, "This is probably the most important thing that has happened in my lifetime." Because the battle is occurring on the college campuses as we speak in many ways. Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, and another staunch supporter of Israel. He's Republican. He voted for Trump. Okay, well, there's a reason why he would be there. But he is a staunch supporter of Israel. Two names you may not remember, Oscar Stewart and Jonathan Morales. Do these names ring a bell at all? Both of them intervened during the Poway Chabad shooting in California, in San Diego earlier this year. They, in essence, helped to bring down the shooter. This was in a Chabad synagogue. They were there speaking, supporting the president and the executive order. Then you have Jonathan Greenblatt. Anybody know the name? Jonathan Greenblatt is the chief executive of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. He is Jewish, and the ADL denounces all acts of anti-Semitism. He was there in support of this as well. The room was packed. Does the title placed upon the president actively reflect the contents within the book? The title that's placed upon him, does it truly represent who he is? This isn't about whether you like or dislike our president. It is about his actions, what he said he was going to do 4 years ago. And is actually what he is doing today. Rather refreshing in that politicians promise the sun, moon, and stars and deliver very little. So let's look at this declaration, this proclamation, this executive order. signed on Tuesday, December 10th, 2019. The heading, "The vile, hate-filled poison of anti-Semitism must be condemned and confronted everywhere and anywhere it appears." Then it says, "Combating anti-Semitism. President Donald J. Trump is issuing an executive order to further the fight against the rise of anti-Semitism in the United States. President Trump's order makes it clear that Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 applies to anti-Semitic discrimination based on race, color, and national origin." So this, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it was... You could never really attach anti-Semitism to this. What did this executive order actually do? Because we're going to read a little further. It actually made Judaism a nationality. So now the power of the Civil Rights Act is now fully equipped for anti-Semitism. When enforcing Title VI against covered anti-Semitic discrimination, agencies will consider the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA, definition of anti-Semitism, as well as the IHRA's contemporary examples. I will conclude with that, but let me finish this first. The president is also directing federal agencies to identify other ways the government can use non-discrimination authorities to address anti-Semitism. This action further demonstrates the unwavering commitment of President Trump and the administration in combating all forms of anti-Semitism. In recent years, Americans have witnessed a disturbing rise in anti-Semitism incidents and rhetoric across the country. In the past few years, there have been a disturbing trend of rising anti-Semitism in the United States. Incidents have increased in America since 2013, particularly in schools and college campuses. That's where this executive order is focused towards, because it's making college campuses accountable. How? By attaching the federal dollars that they get to this, that they have to address it. You want our money? Get in line. These incidents included horrific acts of violence against Jewish Americans and synagogues in the United States. Earlier this year, 18 Democrat members of Congress co-sponsored legislation in support of anti-Semitism. The Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions, the BDS movement. In their resolution, these congressmen and congresswomen shockingly compared support of Israel to support for Nazi Germany. Have we passed the Rubicon yet? President Trump and his administration have repeatedly taken action to combat hate and support the Jewish community. During this year's State of the Union address, President Trump promised, "Never ignore the vile poison of anti-Semitism or those who spread its venomous creed." Does this sound like an anti-Semite to you? Since January 2017, the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice has obtained 14 convictions in cases involving attacks or threats against places of worship. The division has also obtained 11 convictions in cases involving hate crimes against individuals because of their religious beliefs. The DOJ has launched a new comprehensive website providing a centralized portal for law enforcement, media, advocacy groups, and others to access hate crime resources. DOJ Community Relations Services has facilitated 17 forums since September 2018 focused on protecting places of worship and preventing hate crimes. And the president signed the JUST Act, strengthening Holocaust restitution efforts. The Trump administration removed the last known Nazi criminal from the United States. All of these are part of this aspect. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may have expressed as hatred. Oops, let me back up. I talked about the IHRA. This is their definition of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical or physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed towards Jewish and non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community, institutions, and religious facilities. This is just the beginning of that definition. In addition, such manifestation could also target the state of Israel, conceived as a Jewish collective. Anti-Semitism frequently charges Jews with conspiring to harm humanity. Don't blame anyone, just blame the Jews. Blame the Jews for the wars, blame the Jews for the plagues, blame the Jews for whatever you want. Just blame them. And as I mentioned, it's often blame them. Why things go so wrong, blame the Jews. It is expressed in speech, writing, visual forms and action, and employs sinister stereotypes and negative character traits. Here we have the political cartoon. What do you see? You see the liberal case for Israel. And behind it, what do you have? The IDF killing people. So on the surface is one thing, but behind the screen, behind the veil, is something different. Then here you have what you see is the Star of David, the Mogen David, on a viper. The Jewish people are vipers. Here you have a swastika pointing at various things. The Holocaust never happened. And Israel only exists because of the Holocaust. Those people have such twisted logic. And Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth in a Holocaust. Here you have a pig representing Israel, Star of David on it, lying on a pillow of the United States. And I believe it's Arabic that's in the corner. Looking in the mirror, what do we see? Hitler looking right back at him. I mean, this is just a few of the visual. I mean, there's one that most recent one, and I didn't save it. President Trump wearing dark glasses as if he's blind. And you have the face of Benjamin Netanyahu on a dog that is a seeing eye dog, meaning that we blind Americans are being led by Israel. Contemporary examples of anti-Semitism in public life, the media, schools, the workplace, and in the religious sphere could, taking into account the overall context, include but not limited to calling for, aiding, or justifying the killing or harming of Jews in the name of article ideology or an extremist view of religion. Again, this doesn't mean everyone. When I'm talking about the things that many have gravitated towards the Jewish promises, saying that they're theirs as opposed to belonging to the Jewish people, that doesn't mean everyone. Making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as collective, such as, especially, but not exclusively, the myth about a world Jewish conspiracy, or of Jews controlling the media, the economy, the government, Hollywood. accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing committed by a single Jewish person or group. We are not exempt from, how do I put this, from our atrocious people as our contribution to the world. Karl Marx was Jewish. Hitler had a Jewish mother. George Soros. I mean, we're no less guilty of our contribution to the world's systemic problems, yet we get blamed for a lot more than we're responsible for. Accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing committed by a single Jewish person or group, or even for facts or for acts committed by non-Jews. Sometimes we get blamed for doing things that we didn't even do. We get blamed many times. Denying the fact, scope, mechanism, or intentionality of the genocide of the Jewish people at the hands of the nationalist socialist Germany. Socialism. Okay? Now, keeping in mind, Nazism gets viewed as being far right, when actually, nationalist socialist Germany is far left. So this rise of socialism, be careful. Accusing the Jews as people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. Go on the internet. Google Holocaust deniers. You're going to get an earful. Oh, it really didn't happen. Oh, well, the pictures were staged. They were made up. Accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of the Jews. A dual loyalty. How many times have we heard this before? More so in just the last year, talking about dual loyalty. Examples of the ways in which anti-Semitism manifests itself with regard to the state of Israel, taking into account the overall context, could include, again, this is still the definition of anti-Semitism, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination by claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor. Racist endeavor. The state of Israel has been sanctioned more times by the United Nations than by China, Iran, and Russia combined. How about applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation? Okay, let's not just talk about democratic nations. Look at what's going on in China. The human abuse atrocities. What about Iran? Yet Israel is expected to live up to a higher standard than these nations. Double standards. Using the symbols and images associated with classic anti-Semitism, claiming the Jews killed Jesus, or blood libel, the blood is on your hands, or you're guilty of the plague itself because fewer Jews died during the plague. Drawing comparisons to contemporary Israel policy to that of the Nazis. Holding Jews collectively responsible for actions of the state of Israel. You're Jewish. Look what they did. You're responsible. However, criticism of Israel, similar to that leveled against any other country, cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic. This would be known as the double standard of hypocrisy. They continue on, anti-Semitism acts are criminal when they are so defined by law. For example, denial of the Holocaust or distribution of anti-Semitic materials in some countries. Criminal acts are anti-Semitic when the targets of attacks, whether they are people or property, such as buildings, schools, places of worship, and cemeteries, are selected because they are or are perceived to be Jewish or linked to the Jewish people. Anti-Semitic discrimination is the denial to Jews of opportunity or services available to others, and is illegal in many countries. You can't discriminate based on race or religion. Take your pick on those two. These black Hebrew Israelites displayed anti-Semitism through their act of violence, while President Trump displayed the opposite, a measure to counteract this sustained movement of anti-Semitism on humanity. There was actually a third thing that happened this week in denouncing anti-Semitism. It wasn't obvious, but it was significant. Over in the United Kingdom, an election occurred on Thursday. The Tory party, which is the equivalent of the Republican party, won an overwhelming majority. I believe it last count was either 361 or 364 seats of their parliament. An understory to this profound victory was the defeat of the Labour Party, who got decimated. They have like 200 seats now. And they are the equivalent of the Democratic Party and its leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Has anybody heard this name before? Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party and was a staunch anti-Semite. Again, the socialist movement in Great Britain, he was a staunch anti-Semite. Brits were speaking towards their voice being heard in support of Brexit and also against socialism, which has taken a position against Israel and the Jewish people. Google the Democratic Party platform. See if anything in there supports Israel. You might be surprised. In many instances, there is no distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Anti-Jewish people versus anti-Israel. Very little distinction is made. The people of Great Britain spoke against both. Let me conclude with this. I will know it when I see it. Anybody know where that quote came from? Well, you're going to get your history lesson today, although you've gotten a lot of history. The phrase, "I know it when I see it," is a colloquial expression by which a speaker attempts to categorize an observable fact or event, although the category is subjective or lacks clearly defined parameters. It's like trying to define something yet not being able to define it. But when you see it, you'll know what it is. The phrase was used in 1964 by United States Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart to describe his threshold test for obscenity in Jacob Bellis versus Ohio, in explaining why the material issue in the case was not obscene under the Roth test, and therefore was protected speech that could not be censored. This is what he wrote. "I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within the shorthand description of what is hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligently doing so, but I know it when I see it. And the motion picture involved in this case is not that." I don't remember what the picture was. But basically, I'll know it when I see it. This past week, you were able to see what was an anti-Semitic act. And you were able to see what was not anti-Semitic, but in reality was speaking out, acting out against it. So don't assume the contents of a book by its title. labels or titles. You may be labeled something, but is that truly reflective of who you are? So ultimately, the last thing I'm going to say here is pay attention to what is happening around you, because it impacts you either directly or indirectly. But keeping in mind, if it starts off impacting you indirectly, it may eventually find you. We identify ourselves as a Messianic Jewish synagogue. There is the potential for us to be brought into that narrative. Question I will ask you: should that transpire, what will your response be? I'm with them, or I'm not Jewish? Everybody, please rise.